Sharon Batts, you were working in Montreal as a journalist when suddenly you were faced with cancer, breast cancer.
Yes, I was. That was in 1988. And I was 43. I'd never felt better in my life. I was doing a lot of exercise and, you know, it was a good time.
What happened? Take me back to the moment you're in the doctor's office and he announces that you have breast cancer.
Well, I had felt this lump in my breast that didn't feel right. But he said, oh, you know, 99% chance it's benign. So he just took a biopsy or an aspiration, and then got back to me a few days later and said, oh, it's cancer. And I was like, no, I think it's a mistake. It took me a while to believe it, just because I did feel so good. But that's actually a good thing when you have cancer. You know, it suggests maybe it hasn't spread, because you're still, you know, maybe it's still localized, which it was the case for mine.
So what kind of treatment did you have?
I had a lumpectomy, so I didn't have the trauma of a mastectomy, because it was a fairly small lump. It was close to the edge of my breast. But I was told that I was recommended that I have radiation to that breast and following the surgery, and also have a very toxic type of chemotherapy called CAF, cyclophosphamide, adriamycin, and 5-FU. I was stage 2, which is, it's considered early stage, but not really early stage. So that took about 8 months altogether. And I didn't feel good again. You get tired when you're having these treatments and, you know, you're traumatized. But it took me about a year to feel like I was getting my real health back again.
Well, after you'd gone through that and you finally got your health back and presumably your life moved on, it didn't really move on in your case, because you must have had questions about breast cancer and the treatment and the way in which women were regarded.
Exactly. And because I was a journalist and was a bit fanatical about doing research and wanting to understand things, I started reading, I started doing, you know, research, and I was absolutely astounded to find that, you know, I was looking at figures from the Cancer Society, and you know, they put out figures every year about how many people get this kind of cancer, how many people die of that kind of cancer. And there were like 5,000 women a year dying of breast cancer. And yet you would hear these messages like, oh, you know, just go have your mammogram, and, you know, early detection is your best protection. And I had actually had a mammogram when I found the lump. The surgeon sent me to have a mammogram, and the lump did not show up on the mammogram, although you could clearly feel it. So I became aware that mammography was not this magical, technology that one naively believed if you just listened to the slogans. So that kind of awareness, that's when things started to kick in, and I thought, yeah, there's stuff that women aren't hearing that needs to be told.
Well, I think what's amazing is that one person, your good self, managed to really start a lot of interest in advocacy groups. What was happening at the time with health advocacy?
Well, what was happening was we had had the women's health movement very active since the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, the birth control handbook here that came right out of McGill, that was like phenomenally, it was like globally an amazing, amazing document. And then there was the fight for abortion rights and reproductive rights. The thing that was interesting, and I think was a hole or a lack in that movement, was it was mainly women in their reproductive years. They weren't thinking about dying and death and terminal types of diseases. I mean, one of the activists who was really involved at that point, you know, acknowledged this. She said, you know, we didn't really look at breast cancer much, except to, we kind of went along with, we didn't think of it as political. Lung cancer, the same thing. So there was this gap. There was a lot of really, really important work being done by women's health activists, but not so much addressing breast cancer and other kinds of serious diseases. So there was that, but then there was the AIDS movement in the 80s, which was like super active, like really broke boundaries in how sick people, you know, people who were facing death, and often younger people facing death, more often at that point men than women, a very aggressive, very kind of in-your-face, act-up kind of movement. And so here I was with breast cancer. This was in 89. I was still going through my treatments, and there was this huge international AIDS movement here in Montreal. And I was like, whoa, you know, these breast cancer groups aren't saying anything. We don't even talk about this. We're all feeling ashamed because we have cancer and frightened. And here's a group of people who are also really sick, and they're doing amazing things, and they're making a difference, and they're getting the attention of policymakers and being heard. And it's pretty shocking stuff to hear, but it's important to make that kind of impact.
I can remember when they had the International Conference on AIDS right here in Montreal, and It was so inspiring, and they brought that AIDS quilt with them, and they were loud. They were really loud, in your face, as opposed to the women.
Yeah, exactly. So that, I wrote an op-ed that appeared in the Montreal Gazette saying, you know, women with breast cancer have to be asking questions too, and there's a lot of things that we're just not thinking about. So that was published. Somebody phoned me, a woman, or wrote me a note saying, you know, you sound like an activist. If you ever decide to start a group, let me know. And this is a woman named Carolyn Badger, and she was involved with environmental issues and had had breast cancer. Her mother and aunt had had breast cancer. So I wasn't feeling very well at that point. And I knew, because I'd been very involved in women's publishing in the 70s, how much work it is to start a group and be active in a group. So I was writing, I was taking notes. But a couple of years later, in 1991, I called Carolyn and said, yeah, I think I'm ready to start a group. And so we found a couple of other women who had breast cancer. And there was a group that had started in San Francisco right around that time, which is still going, Breast Cancer Action in San Francisco, an amazing group. And they were doing advocacy, and they were feminists, they were taking a critical perspective, and I thought, that's the kind of group we need here. And no, there were no advocacy breast cancer groups at that point in Canada.
Yeah, I think it's important to talk about the difference between advocacy groups and patient groups, because there were patient groups, weren't there, Sharon?
There were groups that were more like support groups. they had a group at the Jewish General called, what was it called, Hope and Cope. yeah, I know, people sort of roll their eyes. It just sounds so like, let's hang on by our fingernails here. But when I was diagnosed, I would have liked to have joined a support group, and there weren't any happening, or, you know, I mean, there was really a dearth, even though there was the idea of support groups and that this was something that people might benefit from. It wasn't like you could just phone up and say, I want to join the support group, because if there wasn't one going at that point, or maybe they were, you know, they'd already started meeting and they didn't want new members, or, you know, it was pretty sad.
So you were working with a couple of women who were more interested in advocacy.
Yes, absolutely. And we met for about a year, and we were reading and talking, and we really, you know, we were all of the same mind. And we thought, you know, we need to open it up and get more members and just kind of see what happens and get the attention of people in government and policy in the hospitals and just talk about the things we're concerned about. And prevention was a big thing that wasn't being addressed, but also, you know, the toxic treatments and, you know, the fact that people didn't seem aware that this was a a big thing, and that the rates were increasing, and nobody seemed to know why. And mammography was sort of being touted as our big, you know, hopeful technology. And all these drugs that, well, there weren't that many drugs, but there were drugs that were quite toxic. And, yeah.
And presumably this was all within the patriarchal culture, which was extremely strong at that point. I mean, I know now that we have so many more women doctors and oncologists, presumably, but in those days, it was very male-dominated, wasn't it? And your body was just a sort of object on the table in front of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I did not have any... Well, I had male doctors, all the males, the cancer specialists I saw were all male doctors. And, you know, not necessarily great at communicating. I mean, I think technically they were very competent doctors. But, you know, I felt like I needed to talk to somebody. And I finally found a woman GP at the Jewish General. So this was a woman named Pearl Feldman. She was wonderful. And so I started seeing her, and that helped a lot in just having somebody who would talk to me in ordinary good language and you know, listen to me.
Yeah, because it must be such a hostile environment. I mean, here you are, you're talking about your breasts,
exactly.
For heaven's sake. I mean, such an intimate part of our body. And you're talking to a strange man,
yeah.
Who's got some kind of scientific background.
Yeah. And another thing that along those lines was, I remember when I was, I think it was when I was in the hospital having my lumpectomy, you know, these young men kept kind of popping up and saying, okay, I'm here to do a breast exam. And I'd be like, what? I mean, I've already had like six of these, you know. We know that I have breast cancer. I don't need a breast exam. But basically they were, you know, they were in training and I was somebody to practice on. And I remember one of these guys, like, he looked so young. He was probably in his early to mid-20s, but I thought, like, you look like a teenager. I don't want you feeling my breasts.
Yeah, so apart from the breast cancer, there was a struggle to have some kind of dignity,
yeah.
Whilst all this was going on.
Good, yeah, very good. That's exactly it. And I understand now, I have been involved in teaching med students that probably wouldn't happen now. There's enough realization that, you know, you have to ask permission, and if the person isn't comfortable, they have a right to say no. But I wasn't aware of that.
Well, I think in those days we just floundered around, right?
Yeah.
We still believed in the power of doctors to heal.
Yeah, I mean, I actually thought when I was first diagnosed, oh well, you know, you go, you have these treatments, are horrible, but then you know, you get on with it. But then, you know, there was this figure of over 5,000 women dying every year. So clearly, the treatments weren't really that effective.
Yeah. So what happened with BCAM, Breast Cancer Action Montreal?
Well, we had our first public meeting. We had a meeting in the basement of the Unitarian Church, which has since burned down because Carolyn was a member there. But we had, I don't know, we put notices up somehow, or we got the word out. And I mean, we were surprised. I mean, people came streaming in the door. There were about 40 people. They were just, you know, we had little a jar. People could give donations, and people were stuffing $20 bills in, and we were like, wow. And they were like, we want to do something. And it was just amazing. We realized that this was something that was needed.
Tell me what kind of actions you did.
We had a very interesting public event where we brought a woman up from the States, a feminist physician who was concerned about the use of tamoxifen, which is one of the treatments. They were doing a clinical trial to see if tamoxifen could be given to healthy women who were considered at high risk because of family history or whatever, and that this could be a way to prevent breast cancer. And we were like, wait a minute.
So can you tell us what tamoxifen is for the young listeners?
Well, tamoxifen is a drug that is actually fairly effective if you have a certain kind of breast cancer that is stimulated by estrogen, and it sort of blocks the estrogen from getting into these estrogen receptors in your breast tissue. So it you know, estrogen does, we know estrogen stimulates breast cancer in many cases. There are different kinds of breast cancer, but for the majority of cases, it is a decent drug. But to give it, it also has side effects, you know, including endometrial cancer and blood clots, and these can be fatal. You know, it's a whole idea of how much risk are you willing to take for us to expose. You'll be exposing hundreds of thousands of women in, say, in North America to a drug that could have fatal side effects when this person might never even get breast cancer.
Yeah, I mean, they wanted to give this to women that did not have cancer but were at higher risk than the population general, right?
Yeah, but when you looked at the figures, it was like, oh, this would be women whose odds of getting breast cancer, instead of being, you know, 1.8, might be 3.6%. I mean, it wasn't like you were a 90% chance of getting breast cancer. You were just like, you know, they would say, well, you know, these are women who have double the risk of the average woman. So the figure, we started to see how the figures could be used to, you know, mislead people into thinking that, to scare them, really. And so we began protesting that. But we brought this woman up from the States, who was a feminist physician, and her group, the National Women's Health Network in the States, which had been going for a long time, since the early 70s, very, you know, good prevention-oriented public health advocacy group. They were concerned about this clinical trial because it had been started in the States, but they were recruiting women in Canada as well. So we brought her up. We had her debating with a physician here named Richard Margulies, who was very keen on recruiting women into the trial. And then there was another woman. She was a researcher at one of the universities here, PhD. She was sort of in the middle. I mean, so we had a pro, a con, somebody kind of in the middle saying. Anyway, so it was an amazing event. We had it at McGill. I think there were 100 or several hundred people coming. There was a really good journalist from the CBC who was interested, who taped it. It got national exposure because the debate was quite intense. And so that was our first big public event, and kind of put us on the map as an advocacy group that was raising issues that were not being talked about.
And I think if I remember that, the idea of giving tamoxifen to healthy women was dropped.
The clinical trial went on. I think it's actually still talked about a little bit. There is a high profile oncologist in the States who still thinks it's the way to go to prevent breast cancer, that it has been proven. We couldn't stop the trial. The trial went ahead. I think a lot of people who would have gone into the trial decided not to. So we had an impact there that people recruiting for the trial didn't appreciate. But, you know, we just felt people have to know, you know, they have to be informed. Perfectly responsible position to take.
Yeah, and then they started other groups, didn't they, across the country? There are other breast cancer advocacy groups.
There was a group of women in Parliament in Ottawa, in the National Parliament, from all parties. They had formed a parliamentary committee to look into breast cancer. So they were women in their 40s who had friends who were getting breast cancer. And so they had it on they were trying to put it on the policy agenda. They picked up on the fact that there were three or four groups that had started, mostly around Montreal and Toronto, of women who had started either support groups or our advocacy group. And they invited us to come and give testimony. And So we were being actually encouraged by people with a national platform in Parliament to talk about these issues from a patient point of view, which we did. And then they had a big national conference and invited two of us. I was one of the two people to sort of head this committee. Our task was to get women from all across the country who were patients to come to the conference, so that it would be researchers, physicians, women, and policymakers. And we would talk about policy issues with the experts. And this was quite radical. And it was an amazing conference. It was here in Montreal. It was called the National Forum on Breast Cancer. So women we recruited from all across the country, just through our own networks, came, and then they went home, and they were so inspired. They wanted to start groups in their own community, which they did. It was sort of, you know, the 93, 94, 95, there was a big kind of raising of awareness at the grassroots level and an energy to put these groups in place. There were some really strong environmental groups and women's environmental groups, and we started connecting with some of the groups that were involved in environmental work. But about the same time, we also had this big wave of neoliberal politics and Paul Martin's budget, where he cutting back on all kinds of, you know, social services and support to these grassroots groups. Because we had quite an interesting system here in Canada that was built up during the previous few decades, where advocacy groups that were doing good work, like, you know, like DES Action, could get core funding. You know, and there were women's centers across the country, you know, working on, you know, abortion issues and, you know, reproductive issues, that, you know, women's shelters that had core funding, so they could actually work. Do support work with women, but also advocacy work with government agencies. There's a bit of an exchange going on, and then that all got cut. It got wiped out in the mid-90s.
Yes, it's really interesting, isn't it, to think back that we were funded to be in the opposition to government policy in our national action, the status of women. We actually were funded by our tax dollars to oppose policies of the government. They wanted that guidance. They wanted to know what we thought.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was a recognition that, you know, there were these opposing voices out there, and they had some important things to say. And this idea that, you know, that industry is very powerful and often gets carried away with its profit motive, and that you need to have these counterweights saying, you know, wait a minute, this doesn't look like it's going to be good in the long term for the population. And so that was it was a totally different philosophy, a way of thinking than has existed for the last 30 years. There was an emphasis on trade, on commerce, on the whole idea that the marketplace would lead, and then every, you know, the wealth would trickle down and we'd all be fine, and we didn't need all these programs, these social programs anymore, that or they were just causing too much of a deficit, and we should just move on to this more commercial model. And so that happened. It did happen over a period of 10 years or so, but it caught the breast cancer movement, I think, a bit off guard. And then the drug companies started coming forward and offering money to groups to support them to do things, just at the time when the government was saying, you know, you're going to have to be independent.
Yeah, so the government is cutting back on the financing, including women's shelters, et cetera, and, of course, the advocacy groups. The groups have no money, but then they're saved by the pharmaceutical companies, who come in and say, we will give you money. So what happened?
That started some really strenuous debates within the groups, because there were a lot of us who had been active in various kinds of sort of protest type groups or advocacy groups in health, environment, human rights groups through the 70s and 80s before this shift happened. And so people were saying, well, no, it doesn't make sense for us to take money from the drug companies. We want to be able to critique them and, I mean, not necessarily oppose everything they do, but we're there to speak for patients, and they're profit-oriented. But then there were people saying, well, no, wait a minute, they're offering us money. They say it's strings-free. They say it's, there's this term, an unrestricted educational grant. They seem like really good people. You know, they have people with cancer in their families too, so, you know, we think that it's fine. So there were these splits and debates. As I see it, and as I describe in the book, it caused total havoc within the groups. There were groups that split, leaders who left the groups, you know, some people who lost their jobs in the groups, as the groups more and more began to move towards taking money from the pharmaceutical companies?
It must have been difficult for some of the groups, because what they had in common, the individual women, was that they had breast cancer, but that they were from very diverse backgrounds, weren't they? They were not necessarily feminists or politically involved in other areas.
Yeah, some of them were and some of them weren't. And some of them were very much involved in, they had a business background, or maybe their family members had jobs in drug companies or in, you know, chemical companies. And they were from a more of a profit-oriented business background. And they were often the ones who were brought into the groups because they knew, they understood the financial field and how to raise money, and they had well-to-do friends, and they would be put on the board, and then, you know, as fundraisers. And then there were the women who were working in the field and seeing women every day and talking to them about their breast cancer experience, who were saying, no, wait a minute, we can't be taking money from drug companies and then talking to women about their treatments.
Yeah, exactly. Can't take money and trash them at the same time. That was the idea.
Yeah, exactly.
What about your involvement? That must have been somewhat problematic, because you're a very independent-minded researcher and you wouldn't dream of taking a cent from a drug company.
I mean, I actually went on a trip to I don't know, somewhere in the States at one point, because we were invited by this San Francisco group, and they were working. There was this company that was developing the drug Herceptin, and they had some early encounters with the company and wanted us to come down. And it was a very confusing time to figure out, like, you know, if we're going to be advocates, maybe we do need to talk to the drug companies, but we don't have the money to go to meetings. So I did actually go to one meeting. There were small encounters that we had with drug companies, and then we decided, no, we need to have a policy, no money from drug companies at Breast Cancer Action Montreal. And that was put in place. It was shortly after I left. I think it was in 2001. And the group in San Francisco had also put that kind of policy in place. There was a group called Willow in Toronto that had that kind of policy in place. Willow, I describe in my book how Willow reversed its policy because of these, they have these high-powered board members raising money who decided, you know, we need the money. But Breast Cancer Action Quebec, as it's now called, has held out, has stayed true to its mandate and its desire to stay independent, not only of drug companies, but of any company that's, you know, making chemicals that are known to promote breast cancer, companies that make mammogram machines, or companies that are involved in the health field. It has decided to stay independent. But it's a small minority. As I document in the book, by 2000, the year 2000, most patient groups, not just breast cancer groups, but patient groups generally, because a lot of diseases kind of jumped on the same idea that the breast cancer groups and the AIDS groups had, that we need to be doing advocacy. And they were all taking money from drug companies at this point. I mean, the drug companies saw this as an important way to influence policy, was to meet with the groups and give them money and, as they put it, educate them about drugs.
Yes, I'll co-opt them. This book that we're talking about, the book that you wrote, in which all this is nicely documented, is called Health Advocacy Inc.
Yes, How Pharmaceutical Funding Changed the Breast Cancer Movement. I did leave Montreal in the late 90s. Part of what happened was I was getting kind of frustrated and feeling like Breast Cancer Action Montreal was still doing really good work, but we were kind of sidelined by the national groups and the other groups. I didn't really understand how it was that so many groups, you know, that were supposedly representing patients had just been so easily, it seemed, kind of wooed by these companies. I was offered a job at Mount St. Vincent University in a position called the Nancy's Chair in Women's Studies. So it was a wonderful two-year job where I was doing some teaching. I was also free to do research. I subsequently had another similar job at Dalhousie called the Elizabeth May Chair in Women's Health and the Environment. So I had 4 years when I was able to do research, and I chose to do it primarily on this whole, you know, neoliberalism, this sort of partnership era where nonprofits form partnerships with corporations. And so then I went on to do a doctorate, and on the same topic, using the breast cancer movement as a case study, but one that I see as having much wider relevance for nonprofit groups in general, but certainly, and certainly patient groups across the board.
Yeah, I mean, Canada does have what we call a single-payer health system, for which we're all extremely grateful. But we don't have a drug plan. Yeah. And I think that we don't realize just how much these drugs cost.
It's starting to make headlines because in the past, well, it's in the past 10 years, but really in the past couple of years, drug costs have just gone through the roof. When we first started Breast Cancer Action Montreal, a lot of women were on tamoxifen. That was costing like $12 a month. So for the full 5 years that you would be on tamoxifen, the cost would be, you know, $3,000 or $4,000. And that was usually covered by insurance. It's quite complicated the way the system works that we have in Canada, because the system was set up to give universal coverage for people when they're in a hospital or when they went to have a doctor's appointment. Drugs were not included, you know, dental care was not included. All these other things were not included at the beginning, but there was this idea that gradually they would be brought in, and they never were. So we're now in the position where drugs, which used to be quite inexpensive, and this all, you know, kind of ties into the NAFTA, you know, the trade agreements where the drug companies push to assert their patent rights, but they've now just become so expensive that most new cancer drugs now are $100,000 or more for a year for one patient, which is, it's crazy because the drugs are not even, we don't even know if they work half the time because they're being pushed through very quickly through the approval process. That was kind of a step-by-step process to prevent disasters like thalidomide from happening ever again. And it's actually the patient groups that are saying, we want these drugs as quickly as possible. We feel like these are potentially life-saving. And of course, they're getting this information from the drug companies who are, you know, that are educating them and paying, you know, some of the salaries of their you know, the people on their, they now call them CEOs, and they've adopted all this commercial language. It's quite frightening because we're now at a point in Canada where we're having a really serious discussion about shouldn't we bring drug coverage into the national single-payer system, which I think we absolutely need to do.
Yeah, but it sounds as though from what you're saying about the process of, you know, testing the drugs, et cetera, that this has been really sort of shortened almost.
Oh,
and
has.
And that with the, you know, the pressure of these advocacy groups, you know, the companies can easily say, well, Canadians want this drug, et cetera, whether it's good or bad.
Yeah, exactly. And that is what is disturbing because the groups, you know, they have, I think, still largely among the general public, the impression, they give the impression that they're there for patients. But when you look closely at the policies that they're supporting, it's not, in my view, for patients at all. It's for the profits of the industry.
Has anything changed in terms of prevention of breast cancer since you were diagnosed, since you had breast cancer?
Well, we do have groups now like Breast Cancer Action Quebec that are doing, you know, really good work to try to raise awareness and to promote an awareness of the toxins in the environment that we know have an impact on health. There's a fair bit of public support, but the groups like, I mean, Breast Cancer Action Quebec, I think they have 1.5 paid staff people. So there's a limit to what they can do. They're not the dominant model of patient activist group. There are, you know, 6 groups that I know of in Canada and the United States that are making prevention at the environmental level a priority. but they're overwhelmed by the pressure to get new drugs, these groups that really want new drugs. Canadian Environmental Protection Act is being revised. They're working on that. And there are really, really fantastic people across the country who are very well informed, who are, you know, having conversations with the federal government, trying to get changes to the Environmental Protection Act. The typical message about prevention that you have with cancer patients is, well, it's your individual choice. You need to be, you know, exercising a lot, eating the right foods. I don't disagree. I mean, I exercise, I try to eat properly, but there's this aspect of the environmental toxins. And even within foods, I mean, there are very powerful industry groups that want to promote certain kinds of food. I mean, drugs themselves they go through your body and they end up in the environment having a toxic effect. That's something I've done some work on. Raising an awareness of and having actual policies with teeth that will restrict the amount of toxins that get into the environment, that's very tough.
How can we be advocating against breast cancer and other forms of cancer?
Well, I think that forming groups and joining groups, the groups that exist, is really important. Forming yourself. I mean, there is information, good information out there. And, you know, keep putting pressure on the government, provincial and national governments, to enforce the kinds of laws that we need.
Is there anything else that we should talk about?
I think it's important to address this issue of funding for groups. Groups that have a critical voice need to have core funding, and that's something that was basically wiped out. The Trudeau government, the Liberal government, has moved a bit away from the very punitive kind of policy that the Harper government had, where they were actually investigating groups that had charitable status, which means they can, you know, give tax receipts. Breast Cancer Action Quebec had to have this elaborate audit of their books. I mean, so all these little groups doing environmental protection work were being targeted. I think that there is a budget to do that the Harper government put in place and the Liberals got rid of it. So that's one step. But we need to go the next step and actually provide core funding to these groups so that we can have critical voices out there.
Well, thank you very much, Sharon, anyway, for all that talk. It's been so interesting.
Thank you so much for your good questions.